Earth and Sky.
Welcome to Clear Voices. I'm Jorge Salazar. Few have seen the Earth from space, but that might change in the coming years as the space tourism industry takes off. What's more, the U.S. space agency, NASA, has bold plans in the coming decades to return to the moon and go to the planet Mars. I spoke with Eileen Collins, the first woman to pilot and command the space shuttle. She talked about the new book, America in Space, NASA's first 50 years. And she spoke of her experiences as an astronaut and the future of space travel. Here's Eileen Collins.
Commander Collins, welcome to Earth and Sky.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
What inspired you to become an astronaut?
Well, I'd go all the way back to my childhood. I remember in fourth grade, I was reading a junior scholastic magazine that had an article with the pros and cons of spaceflight. And even as a 10-year-old child, I wondered, how could anyone say con? Of course, we ought to explore space. And the article primarily was talking about the Gemini program. The emphasis was on space exploration. And I'm not sure why, but even though there were no women astronauts in 1965, I still wanted to be an astronaut.
Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences out in space? What is it like to look at the Earth from space?
I remember on my first mission back in 1995, I had all my expectations, but after main engine cutoff and doing a few checklist items, my flight engineer floated up behind my shoulder and said, "Eileen, look out the window. This is your first sunrise from space." And as I looked out the window and I saw the sun coming up in the curvature of the Earth, I thought, wow, the Earth is round. And, you know, I'm laughing here because, of course, the Earth is round. But when I saw it with my own eyes, it meant something different to me. And looking at the Earth's atmosphere and seeing how thin it is, you realize how fragile. I mean, it sounds like I've heard this a million times before, but it's true. The Earth is a very fragile planet. And it drove home the point that we are living on a sphere that is being hurled around the sun, and we are exposed more than we think to space, the darkness of space. We have a thin atmosphere. We live on a water planet. When you look at the Earth, you are going to see water or clouds most of the time. When you look down and you see land, for the most part, you initially don't know what you're looking at. But when you eventually get yourself oriented and see and figure out where you are, you think about all the people that live down there and all the history that has taken place and places you'd like to visit someday. I have to say the most striking places on the planet are the deserts, which include the Sahara Desert, the Middle East, and Australia. Because when you see those areas, they're normally cloud-free, and there's a huge contrast between the bright, sunny, tan desert, the blue waters, and the darkness of space. And the last part is the environmental effects that you can see on the planet, like you can see volcanoes. In every one of my missions, I think I've seen a volcano smoking somewhere in the world. And the tropical coral reefs, which we did a study on my third flight with a high-definition camera. And you can also see erosion in places like Central Africa, the island of Madagascar. And you can see fires burning as people are clearing land. And these are routine sites that you'll see on a mission. You're going to see signs of erosion if you know what you're looking at. For example, the river deltas that would normally be a deep blue, or where the rivers exit into the ocean, you'll see more of a brownish color. And if you compare what you're seeing with historical photos from the Skylab period in the 1970s, you can see that there's so much more deforestation on the planet nowadays. Now, I'm not a scientist, and these areas are not my expertise, but as an astronaut, we are taught by the scientists what to look for, what to observe, what to photograph. So these are things that we do to help support their studies. And I try not to make comments on the environment because I can get myself in trouble because, frankly, it's not my area of expertise, but I certainly can comment on what I've seen.
What do you miss about flying the space shuttle?
Well, you know, honestly, the first thing that comes to mind is the people, working with the people. Some very, very top-notch, dedicated people that are in the job because they really believe in space exploration, getting people off the planet, working in low Earth orbit, and just the, I would say, the attitude of moving on beyond low Earth orbit and getting people back to the moon and eventually onto Mars someday. The people in the space program believe in this mission, and they know that the long-term survival of people on this planet will depend on our ability to, you know, leave the planet and explore the world around us and really understand the planet, you know, better from that perspective. And it, people are very dedicated to that mission. I think that space tourism is going to be a successful industry someday because that experience of looking back at the Earth, floating in microgravity in low Earth orbit, is something that people will pay money to do, to have that experience as part of their life. And as time goes on, I believe these companies will be safer in their missions and their hardware. I believe that the cost will eventually begin to come down, and more people will have the opportunity to have that experience, which is just a great human experience.
Looking back and looking forward, I guess to start with, what do you think are the greatest achievements that NASA has made over its 50 years?
Well, you know, that actually gives me a chance to mention the book that NASA has just, I would say, cooperated in publishing, a book called America in Space, NASA's First 50 Years. And you look all the way back to, actually it begins with the launch of Sputnik, which was October 4th of 1957, just 50 years ago, and NASA was established shortly after that in 1958. And it's hard to believe that in 50 years we've come as far as we have. The launch of Sputnik, which was the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth, and then the U.S. launch of Explorer, and the beginning of the human space program, all the way up to the space station that we have today in low Earth orbit. In fact, as I speak, there's six people on the space station. To think that from 1957 to 1969, in just about 12 years, we put a man on the moon is just phenomenal. To think that our country was able to do something as, I would say, futuristic as putting a man on the moon and, of course, returning him safely to Earth. I'm sorry to see that we haven't been able to continue that mission. I think that the cost has been the number one reason that we don't have bases on the moon right now and that we haven't had a person on Mars. But our country does have plans to go back. You know, now we're looking forward towards the next 50 years. Our country does have plans to build research stations on the moon, not just to visit and return, but to go there and stay and learn what we can and use the resources on the moon in whatever ways that we can, and then eventually send people onto Mars.
Would you like to maybe talk a little bit about that idea? It's of sending someone, sending a group of people on such a long mission. What would it be like? How would you imagine, you know, people living, living a good piece of their lives, you know, spending so much time out in space? What would that be like?
Well, that's very interesting because I'm not sure we know the answer to that. We're studying people in low Earth orbit right now. We've had people on the space station since 1999. It's been permanently manned since November of 1999. And the NASA doctors and researchers are studying the human body and the changes that take place. And I think we all understand how, you know, we lose the strength in our bones, we lose calcium out of our bones, the heart and the muscle get weaker due to the fact that they're really not stressed in the microgravity environment the way they are on Earth in 1G. The human body is exposed to radiation in space, and there's changes, I think, that are taking place that we're still trying to understand. Now, if we look at the lunar surface, we do have gravity there. It's about 1/6 of the Earth's gravity, which I think would be helpful for our adaptation, but I think we're still going to see some physiological effects with the human body and people staying on the lunar surface for long periods of time. So we're going to start by taking, you know, smaller steps. We've already had people on the moon for, you know, 3 days at a time. Our first mission's back to the moon, probably 12 years from now. Hopefully we'll have people back there. Those missions will be longer. The first crew there can be up to 4 people, and that is yet to be determined. But those crews will stay there for a longer period of time. Again, that is yet to be determined, but I think instead of 3 days, it'll be more on the order of 6 months. But by that point in time, we'll hopefully have enough data from our astronauts who have volunteered their bodies for scientific research in low Earth orbit. We'll have more data, so we'll have a better idea of how to protect our lunar astronauts. I think our biggest issue is solar radiation. In the space station, we can protect our astronauts by having them go into a safe haven if we know there's a solar storm that's about to hit. But we have yet to figure out how we're going to do that on the moon. There's been many proposals. But I think that probably the radiation is the biggest issue that we have to deal with. So, long answer, again, to a very good question. But maybe I should also add, how are we going to get to the moon? The space shuttle program will end in 3 years. We're targeting September of 2010. For a variety of reasons, it's the right thing to do to stop flying the space shuttle. We will replace it with the Orion spacecraft that can take 6 people to the space station or 4 people to the moon. And it will launch with the Ares 1 launch vehicle. We'll also have an Ares 5 launch vehicle, which will be ready in the lunar time frame of around 2019 to take the heavy payloads like the lunar lander up into orbit. So there is a program that's in work right now, and for this program to really take off with the limited budget that we have, we need to stop flying the space shuttle.
Commander Collins, I really appreciate taking this time out to speak with me. Thank you very much. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with the public today and the listeners of Earth and Sky?
Well, yes, I'd like to let people know that NASA has got this book out called America in Space, NASA's First 50 Years, and it's a picture book. You could call it a coffee table book, but it's in bookstores now, and it's a very motivational and exciting book. If you have children that are interested in the space program, or if you are interested in the space program, I think you'll see a lot of great memories, a lot of great photographs of both the human and the technical and the scientific side of our last 50 years in space.
That was astronaut Eileen Collins on the book America in Space, NASA's First 50 Years. And I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.